This is Pam Electric Ghost, and we're live on there. We're with Ann Swanson. She's the author of Meditation for the Real World and some other books. And we're going to talk to her today on our podcast live. And we're live on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch. And we'll also be on Newsly later. And if you use coupon code GHOST, you can check that out for 30 days with no obligation to pay. We are a featured podcast on that platform. So welcome to the Fam Electric Ghost podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I'm so glad to be here.
So one of the first questions we always ask people is what motivates you and why do you do what you do?
I teach meditation and mind-body practices, and what motivates me is the fact that they've changed my life. They've transformed me. I used to be so anxious as a creative person, juggling so many things. I was just very anxious. I had sleep issues and chronic pain. And meditation has made the world of difference for me. So I'm happy to share it with other people now and see their transformations.
That's really, that's inspiring because I think a lot of times it's like when you learn how to, something that helps yourself and then you can teach or mentor other people to kind of like passing it forward. So like one of the questions you like to answer is like, what if you feel like you're bad at meditating or your mind wanders too much? What are the kind of, things that you can do to lessen that?
Yeah. A lot of people come to me and they say, I can't meditate. I've tried and my mind wanders too much. But really, that's the point of meditation. It is boot camp for your focus. So you're coming to it with a wandering mind, like all of us. All of our minds wander. Harvard research shows that our minds wander 47% of our waking hours. So if your mind is wandering, you're just normal. Okay. It's part of being human. And meditation is a skill you learn, not something you're born with. It's training your mind to come back to the focal point and focus quicker, better, longer to get into that flow state with everyday life better also. So I would say to them, oh, go ahead. I was just going to say, I would say to them, you're normal. And that's why you come to meditating. It gets better with time.
Do you find that people kind of like in the West have kind of a resistance to it? Like, if you deal with people in the East or other parts of the world that have more of a history with this type of practice, and they're not thinking it's foo-foo or they're not thinking it's like so hard because it's kind of been passed down or it's part of the culture.
Yes.
And so is there part of that Western mindset of not thinking about, having science-based things and pills and procedures and something that kind of not is more esoteric and harder to get your hands around. It seems like more the creative people can kind of get into it, maybe, but other people who are less prone to that are like, oh, I don't know about that.
That's such a good question. I've never had anybody ask me that, and it's thought-provoking. I think when it's a part of the culture, then you know it to be true. It feels more true if it's something you've been exposed to your whole life. And here, we do rely on science to support things. We want a quick fix also, and we don't normally think of meditation as being a quick fix. And I really focus on the science of meditation. My first book was Science of Yoga, and then this book is Meditation for the Real World. But I teamed with a Harvard researcher who peers into the brains of beginner meditators all the way to monks and fancy MRI machines and sees the transformations. We have emerging and exponential growth of research supporting meditation for your brain, for your mental health, for your genetics, for your immune system, getting sick less, for your sleep. So I do find that the Western people do need more of that. And the good news is there is more of that. There is more evidence than ever that meditation works. There's a reason that biggest CEOs at Google and Microsoft are meditating. This works.
Yeah. It's interesting because just a little kind of information. I lived in Japan for like two years. And my wife was a practicing Buddhist. And so we already, when we got married, we're kind of in this mindset of like, you know, understanding Eastern philosophy and even living in Tokyo. And it was just part of our normal everyday to, you know, we chant, we do our Buddhist kind of, you know, processes and practices that are, you know, understandable to us, but to other people, they're like, oh, why are you doing that? And it seems like I think is it hard to maintain for a lot of people once they get into a consistent practice, because are they kind of doing it as a fad rather than something that they need to be able to incrementally and do consistently to actually have the benefit?
Yes, I'll answer that first, but I hope we can get more to the chanting because there's some interesting science to support chanting and music and meditation. So hopefully we'll circle back to that. But yeah, I find, you know, sometimes people will start to meditate. They'll do it for a couple of days. Maybe you download an app, you do it for a few days and you're like, my mind was wandering or I don't have time for that, you know. But the ways to develop a habit based off of science are clear. We want to take our new habit, meditation, and we want to put it next to something we already have a strong habit of. So your meditation practice could start as a 1 minute meditation. And I recommend integrating 1 minute meditations into your life because you can get immediate results. So 1 minute meditations could be a cue during your day, you know, right before you eat, taking a pause of appreciation for the food, smelling it and saying what you're grateful for. There's a 1 minute meditation. It could be right when you floss. Every time you floss, you do it mindfully and then you sit and you do a 1 minute meditation. So you find an activity you're already doing. I integrate 1 minute meditations. Like if I'm noticing I'm getting really stressed about something or I'm about to go on a talk and I need to be focused right before I click accept to that Zoom call, I'll do a 1 minute meditation. So finding cues through your day to integrate them, and that will help you stick with a habit. If you want to do a 10 minute meditation, you know, maybe you make your coffee or tea in the morning and you have it brewing and you're smelling it. And before you take that first sip, you do your meditation every day. That's going to be a great way to feel like you accomplished something right before you take that sip of coffee or tea. So we want to pair it with something that we already have a habit of or a cue in your day that you can integrate it.
Yeah, you got to make it kind of like, and I'm a musician. One of the things is like, you, in order to maintain your capability, you like, you can't, you know, I'm a pianist, I'm a keyboardist. Yeah. So I practice. And so it's like you kind of have to show up or you lose ability. Like, yeah. Any athlete knows if they want to maintain that 3-point shot, they've got to have a certain level of discipline. And yes. I think it's like everything you can take a lot of things from athletics and from music. It's kind of that idea of practice and making your mind practice. There's some things you can do. They're not like physical or maybe physical time you spend chanting. Like I chant in the morning and I chant at dinner time and I chant before I go to bed. And it's just become something that's like routine. I just made it part of my life and it's there. Yes. And once you set it to like, it just becomes like automatic. It's like muscle memory. If you can get something to that, it's like part of your routine, then it's not so hard. Then you don't have to say, well, it's too hard. You know, it becomes like, you know, part of your process.
Yeah.
And being alive.
Yes. Yes. And practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes presence. The more you practice meditation, the easier it becomes to be more present in your daily activities, in your meditation. And when you're more present, research has shown that that seems to be one of the causes of happiness. Not just a correlation, but cause. When we're present doing whatever we're doing, ranging from washing the dishes to having sex, if you were present doing it, you were happier than if you were thinking about your list of things to do. So the more you practice presence in your meditation, the more present and mindful you become through the day. But I find the whole world is obsessed with mindfulness, and the common advice is just be mindful. Just be present all the time. Well, humans, our mind wanders 47% of the day. It's not great advice. We need to do these check-ins where we can realign, where we can train our brain to come into that presence. So whether that's your chanting practice for 10 minutes every morning and evening, or that's your 1 minute meditation when you notice you're about to blow a fuse and yell at your kids, that's your moment to check in and realign, reset your nervous system so that you can be more present more often.
It's interesting because I think a lot of times it's like there's a kind of dichotomy between like if I'm a creative person, I kind of go into the flow state. Mm. It's kind of like a dream state. It's kind of like being inspired by the muse. And you kind of don't know exactly what's going on other than you're in tune with like a vibration or a feeling, and you get into this kind of zone. And you're present, but you're kind of in this kind of dream state, like a living state, you know, waking dream state that a lot of artists get into. But then like the meditation is different than that. It's more focused where the, you know, if I'm meditating or chanting, like I have a specific kind of thing where I'm trying to get into this to kind of like less noise in my world. So I'm not wandering. I'm like trying to be more disciplined, I guess, versus the creative state. So it's kind of like, you know, if I'm going to jam session and play music, I'm kind of in this kind of flow state versus that meditative state.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up because I bust a lot of myths in meditation for the real world. And one of the myths is, you know, like, well, I love to play guitar. Am I already meditating? I'm getting in flow state. Is that meditation? And you're right. It's not meditation. It can be meditative. We can find that overlap between the two. But flow state is that psychological state where you are completely immersed in what you're doing. Like you were saying, it's like time dissolves and you're just focused on whatever art you're doing, whatever action you're doing, whatever sport you're playing. Now, with meditation, when you're meditating, it can put you into flow state. So it can be a type of flow state, but not all flow states are meditation, because the brain areas that are active during guitar playing or playing the piano, they're different than that of meditation. But when you meditate, you can get into flow state easier, quicker, longer. So I often will do like a 1 minute meditation before I'm about to start my craft, before I'm going to write, before I'm going to paint, before I'm going to do my art. I'll do that 1 minute meditation or even just a few breaths to settle in, to arrive. And then I'm able to get into flow state. I'm able to transition from the go, go, go of the day back into the art and get into that state of being inspired by the muse.
Yeah, I kind of also heard like a lot of artists will say that if you get to a place where you kind of just get to peace and quiet and like no noise, no cell phone, no getting pinged by your smartwatch, not, you know, getting the news on a TV, that you get to a place where you have some quiet before you go to try to do like anything, like whether you're trying to do art or anything you're trying to do, that if you can kind of clear your mind of the noise. Is that kind of a meditative pre-process of not trying to focus, but trying to get rid of the clutter or the noise or all the things that are kind of going on?
It can be, for sure. Being in silence can be really helpful. But one thing I fear of saying that is that people are going to think, in order to meditate, I need it to be silent. And that's not true. Yeah. You could have kids playing in the background. You could have noises of ambulances and be meditating. And actually, that's, I think, an optimal place to meditate. When you can practice and you start noticing those noises and you can still be focused on whatever your focal point is, right? So maybe your focal point is your breath. Maybe you put on headphones and your focal point is a song. That's what you're listening to. I do a lot of sound healing where I'll listen to songs that are specifically engineered to optimize your brainwaves through entrainment. And I've been working with a producer. She has 2 master's degrees in music, and we just created a meditation music album, and different songs are engineered to put you in alpha brainwaves to be more relaxed, or theta brainwaves to be more creative. And so you can specifically listen to the theta brainwaves before you go and do something creative. And that'll get you into that flow state, creative state easier. So your focal point could be the sounds around you. It could be the annoying click of the radiator. That's your focal point. You're just hearing it and you're trying to observe the emotions coming around it and not be reactive. That could be your focal point. So yeah, I guess it doesn't have to be silent is what I want to emphasize there, but it's nice to have silence too. But it's also nice to have nature noises. I listen to recordings of like nature noises.
Yeah. Well, I live in New Hampshire. So walking in the pines is very restorative. And it's kind of like I think Thoreau was talking about, you know, nature is the cathedral. So if you go out into the woods or Longfellow, if you go out there, you know, it's very restorative just to be in the woods. And there's not quiet in the woods. There's all these nature sounds. There's the birds, insects, there's all the bustle of the, you know, Merrimack River, because I'm in New Hampshire. But it just feels like when you're in that flow state, and I'm a synthesis. So what I do is I create, take waveforms. And I create sounds from like scratch with oscillators. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like to build like newfound sounds from these oscillators, just kind of go wherever they take me. Because, and it just feels like when I get in, I get lost in it. I get, you know, you could go for 2-3 hours trying to just build a sound before you even build a song.
Yeah.
And it just come up with something unique. And I find it very cathartic. And do you find that creative people kind of already have a lot of cathartic practices kind of tied to their art, like when they get into the painting or they get into the photography or they get into whatever they're doing, that kind of gives them that kind of cathartic peace of mind?
Yeah, but unfortunately, creative people have a lot of maladaptive cathartic activities that we do, right? We look throughout history at the top writers and artists and musicians, and there's drug addiction, there's alcoholism, there's depression, anxiety. So I think integrating a meditation practice can help you have an adaptive, a positive, a healthy sort of a creative process. And I found that, you know, what I was just describing with listening to sound waves specifically engineered to change your brain waves, the music can be what researchers call digital drugs. Music can be digital drugs. And same with meditation, is that we have a pharmacy in our brain that creates all the chemicals, serotonin, dopamine, all the endorphins, all of the pain relievers, morphine. We have all that naturally. And meditation helps us to balance those chemicals and to release them in proper amounts so that you're not feeling depleted where you need drugs necessarily. So I think that meditation can help you tap into more adaptive sort of, as you were saying, like things that creative people can come to get that inspiration, to be cathartic.
Well, I think it's interesting because I think that is the kind of pitfall that a lot of creative people, because you could, you know, some artists, they spend, you know, all day getting ready to be on stage, and then they get that really high, just being on stage, it gives them that kind of natural high, but being in a moment of that sound creation and the interaction with the audience, and then they're not in that state the rest of the day. And because they're not in that state the rest of the day, they kind of feel like they need it, and then they use other things to get to it. And then if you can find alternative, non-harmful practices that don't, you know, and we know the history of artists is like, they tend to, the pitfall is because they want to feel that crowd, and they're not in the crowd, they're not in that situation, they go to other things that are not helpful. And so like having something that's more balanced, and, you know, being a Buddhist, having balance in your life is kind of like the idea of the practice of why we chant and why we try to focus on our meditation, is to give ourselves a way to kind of deal with the extremes of life. Life is like, you know, it goes up and down. It's a wave. Mm-hmm. And how do you keep yourself from, like, you know, being thrown off the ship?
Yeah, it takes practice. And that's a lifelong practice for us. Listen, I'm an art school dropout. I went to art school. I was there on scholarship. And then I became a documentary film artist on my own and went in that direction. And now I'm a writer and I work with artists. So I am around a lot of artists. A lot of my friends who went to art school. And so I know these coping mechanisms we tend to have and the struggles that we tend to have as creative people. And meditation has just been the biggest thing to help me deal with my anxiety around perfectionism of being an artist and creating and putting things out in the world, you know, being a recovering perfectionist.
That's one thing I've always been into is kind of the happy accident. And I like, I'm a child of the 70s. And so one of the things I think is one of the greatest tools for artists is the computer, which one of the biggest detriments, because with the computer, you can spend all your time trying to make something perfect. Yeah. In the music world, like the digital tools we have, we can go in and we can correct the bars. We can correct the timing, and you can end up spending so much time trying to take something that you did and not letting it be. And it's kind of like if you're a child of the 70s, you put it down on tape, you played it, and if there's no micro timing or micro tonal errors, it was part of the kind of beauty of the piece. And now we spend so much time trying to make things perfect that as a producer, I always let people know, it's like maybe taking take three to take 99, even if it has imperfections, actually that version of the song sounds better to me because it feels more authentic. It feels more human. Like vulnerable. Yeah, and if you try to get away from the vulnerability because you're trying to make it perfect, and then you wreck it, you kind of wreck the art.
It feels like a robot made it. I remember when I was in Girl Scouts, my mom was presenting these weavings done by Native Americans, and she said that these weavings, look closely at them, you'll find they look perfect from a distance, but there are specific stitches that are out of perfection on purpose. They did that on purpose because they don't believe anybody should be perfect but the gods, and they want to show their humility and humanness. And there's something special about that. I remember being like, wow, that's really special that these are handmade. They're not done by a machine. And we can tell because of that stitch right there. Yeah. It feels more live and human and authentic.
Yeah, there's some Japanese woodworking processes that don't use like metal fasteners that are very kind of imperfect. They're not uniform. Like depends on what you're doing. It could be how you fasten something. It could be very unique per individual piece of work that you're working on. And it was really interesting that they had this thing, and there's, you know, a couple of things in the Japanese culture where you have some pottery that has imperfections in it on purpose. And you're like, that's really cool. And it's kind of like, you know, I'm a jazz kind of guy, and I like the idea of like fusion or experimental jazz or experimental bebop, where you have some dissonance, you have some like disharmony. You have some, you know, things that are a little off the clock on the rhythm on purpose as part of the piece. And you can use the harmony to kind of bring things in and then go out. And it's like, it's all peace, but it's not all perfect. It's like, lets it be what it is. And that sometimes is very hard for people because it's vulnerable and authentic, and it's not, maybe it's not everybody's cup of tea.
And sometimes it's more beautiful. Like, and they'll have the bowls in Japan that have a crack in them. And when they have a crack in them, rather than throwing them out and starting over, they fill it with gold. And that bowl looks so much more beautiful when it has that imperfection highlighted even.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing, is it's hard to get some people, you know, to understand that, because they get into this perfection comparison trap where they'll look at what's popular, something that gets a million views, you know, 1,000 plays, 100,000 plays, and they say, I gotta be exactly like that, rather than realizing that your strength is your human individuality. That person already did that. So you're just cloning something that was done, and you're probably not going to be exactly what they did unless you just copy it and cut and paste it and sample it, and it's exactly the same thing. It's like, well, what's the point of that? So, but it's my whole thing is like, it's boring to kind of keep on doing the same thing over and over. It's, you know, I look kind of, we had this period in music in the 60s into like the 80s where we, the companies allowed things to happen. Frank Zappa said, back then we saw these like record company executives and we didn't really like them. But one thing we did, we should understand is they didn't know if it was good. They would say, I don't know if this is good, but let's give it a shot. Mm-hmm. We'll see if it has a market. And then Zappa said, like, today we have these people that think they know better, and then they won't allow that type of work to come out because they did their market research and they're a little too knowledgeable. So they won't even allow, where Zappa said, like, the 60s and the 70s allowed some very experimental artists to get to the public. And you're like, wow, maybe we need some of that again.
Yeah, now we have the algorithm to determine it.
Yeah, an algorithm is like, that's not a human being, or that's just trying to hit a metric. And like, art isn't really always defined by the metric.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that what meditation gives me as an artist, as a creator, is the ability to listen to my own heart and intuition. To take a moment to listen. We think of prayer as like speaking to God. And then meditation has the neural activity more similar to listening. Listening to the universe, listening to your muse, listening to God, listening to that inspiration, visualizing. The areas of our brain that have to do with visualizing become active when we meditate. So it can get you out of speaking to and following the algorithm and that cognitive state, and more into that place of listening and being open and listening to your heart, your intuition, what feels right to you.
Also, I think it's important about like listening and being present. Because mm-hmm. a lot of times, like in a modern world, people are trying to like win the argument, or they're thinking about their next response to the conversation without actually listening to what the person said. So then they're not actually understanding what they're in. They're in a conversation, but they're thinking about their response rather than really taking in what did the person just say. Mm-hmm. And if they don't really take in what they said, they took a piece of it and they didn't really hear it. And they're already jumping to their response without really understanding what they just heard.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I'll sometimes just like write down a letter or draw a little picture, and then I'm like, oh, it's done. I don't need to think about it anymore. You know, doodling actually is very helpful for our ability to pay attention. Just doodling increases your memory retention by a significant amount. And a lot of people, especially with ADHD, know that, you know, playing with something or doodling can help them pay attention. And that kind of helps me be able to focus more too. So there's lots of tools that you can use to help you focus in meditation and in everyday activities.
And also you were talking about like in your, the write-up I was reading is like a lot of times, meditation, you're talking about how it helps with anxiety and chronic pain and severe arthritis. And mm-hmm. I want to kind of dive into that, like how that actually, you know, substantially impacts those things.
Yes. Some of the most convincing research we have on meditation is how it impacts our mental health and the ability to help us relieve chronic pain. And I am a case study for this because I've had chronic joint pain since I was a teenager. I mean, I would be left bedridden for days if I had too much alcohol or I pulled an all-nighter for school. And I thought that was normal to be like in that much pain. But then I noticed my friends weren't experiencing that. And so I've had to deal with inflammation-based pain. And when it becomes chronic, your brain is interpreting the messages wrong. It's not like when you burn yourself, you know, obviously that hurts, you pull your hand away. When it's 6 months or so, or after that amount of time, your brain is misinterpreting the signals. So you can retrain your brain. And what scientists are finding is that meditation and things that affect your brain are even more beneficial than something specifically for that body part. When there's a problem in the body, the answer is often in the head. And when there's a problem in the head or the mind, mental health, the answer is often in our body. We feel better when we exercise, when we move, when we walk in nature, right? And so I have found that meditation has retrained my brain to switch those interpretations, as well as anxiety. It trains your brain how to relax quicker, how to notice the signals. And then on a neurological level, when we look at the tissue of the brain, when we age, when we deal with anxiety and trauma or chronic pain, specific areas of the brain start to degrade in their gray matter tissue, and the like tissue becomes even literally smaller. Like your brain gets smaller, especially in critical areas, like at the front of your brain. Prefrontal cortex helps you like focus and plan things, evaluate things. And so what we found is that meditation rebuilds the areas of the brain that tend to degrade with anxiety, depression, trauma, chronic pain. So it directly is an antidote when you look at it physiologically. This isn't just woo-woo stuff. This is things that we have a lot of evidence to support, that it helps on a physical level, an emotional level, a real level in people's lives.
Well, it seems like you're exercising the capabilities of your brain, and people still don't understand everything that you can do with your brain. It's like the most powerful, you know, computer in the world, and people always think supercomputers are more powerful. Their brain capacity is more powerful than any computer that's ever been built. It's just that we don't fully understand it. Now, I'm a software designer, so I'm kind of into it, and I understand, your computers are this and that. It's like, well, your brain is still better than the computer. You know, computers is very limited. It just knows zeros and ones. Everything is just zeros and ones. Like, we got really complicated with it, and we figured out how to do somewhat of an AI, but it's like still not matching what a human brain does.
Yeah. Neuroscientists are basically like astronauts. This is like undiscovered frontier. We really don't understand a lot. And we are exploring it like exploring new universes. And when we find out new things, it completely changes the paradigm. So what we're understanding now about the brain is that it's not just specific areas that are working in isolation. You know, this area is for your memory. This area is for your focus. It's actually networks of activity. It's more holistic. It's what Eastern philosophy has been saying this whole time. Is it a mind-body connection? Yeah. Everything's working together in unison. And so you're able to, through meditation, you're able to turn up the networks in your brain that are related to higher functioning, to making good decisions, to connecting and feeling more compassionate with other people. And then you're turning down the selfish areas of the brain that have to do with mind wandering, me thinking. And this is something that Eastern philosophy has been talking about forever, is this ego, this focus on self, and how that's really an illusion. So we're seeing that how meditation affects our brain makes a lot of sense to the Eastern philosophy.
Well, you're talking also about the two-way street, where like your mental capacity has power over your organs, right?
Yes.
Power over your blood flow,
over your
blood pressure, your cells.
Yes.
If you get to like, you know, the monks, you know, have all these like a lot of religious or, you know, Eastern philosophy people, like where monk level people had focus, kind of laser focus on seeing that connection and understanding that if they practice mentally, they could do kind of like this remapping that we're talking about today, that they were kind of knowing that already. And maybe they talked about it in a different language, in a different cultural perspective. And we look at it all foo-foo. That's just mythology. But, you know, we find today, there's a lot of stuff from indigenous cultures and from Eastern cultures. There's a lot of truth in what they were doing, because they had a lot of mind over matter, you know, that they had these ideas that actually seemed, that does work.
Yeah, neuroscience is just beginning to uncover what these ancient masters and native traditions have known for ages. It's really actually quite behind in a lot of ways.
Not where they were, because maybe we didn't really value their knowledge and actually catalog it when we could have.
We're starting to now. And I mean, you talk to these these neuroscientists, and they meditate. Like, they're like, yeah, I'm convinced this works. This really works. I'm rewatching, or actually just watching, the Avatar series that's live action. I just started it yesterday. And the Avatar, he's basically a Tibetan monk, you know, like a Dalai Lama. He's dressed in the Tibetan monk. I traveled to Tibet when I was younger several times because I studied Buddhism too. And it's so cool to see the powers he taps in through meditation. And these are called in yoga philosophy, siddhis, these superpowers, like your ability to fly and come back from the dead. But a lot of these things are superpowers we can have. Like, you can change your blood chemistry immediately. You can change your cellular activity. You can reverse the age of your cells biologically so that your cells and body parts are acting younger and more efficient through meditation. So we can do things that I would call quite magical is what we're
uncovering. I just wonder, like, if Western culture and the pharmaceutical industry would be like, they don't really have an interest, you know, business-wise, and having somebody do that through meditation versus taking a pill or taking a procedure, because that means that's a cost center, that's cost, that's money they don't get. So that might be part of the kind of Western philosophy, is like, there's less of if you do it yourself through your own discipline, then, you know, you're not paying me.
that is a big part of it. We want a pill to fix it. But really, the solution is in you. You are able to, I mean, of course, there's benefits of Western medicine when we need it. I definitely support that. But I mean, a lot of the extraneous procedures and medicines that we're taking, you have access to be able to make those shifts yourself. So that's why we call meditation as a part of integrative medicine. It's something that can improve your health in meaningful ways through practice alongside your medical care and make it work better.
And also, just wonder, I mean, if you dive into this, but being holistic, there's a lot of connections between like diet in your body and your mind and your exercise. Like, and so are there things that you dive into in terms of nutrition and meditation? Is there any kind of linkage?
Yeah, there's a linkage in that meditation has been shown to make people make better lifestyle decisions. So you're more likely to be mindful and be more thoughtful in your decisions of what food you're going to eat. You're going to notice when you're satiated. You're going to notice when you're full. You're going to notice the cravings of things that your body's truly asking for, what nutrients your body wants. You'll start to crave, you know, oh, I'm craving yogurt right now. I'm craving, you know, something healthy that your body, a nut, because your body's asking for that, rather than being kind of fooled by the sugar.
Sugar and salt.
Yes, sugar and salt.
So it's sugar, salt, fat. You know, that's kind of what we get triggered because we like it. You know, you get satisfied, it's unsalty and it's got sugar and it's got high fat. It's like, that's kind of like, oh, those are the junk food, the immediate gratification. And then it's like, you know, eating the carrot, in the collard green, in the beet, like, you don't necessarily feel that immediate satisfaction, you know, from eating it, that your body gets. And so if you get more in tune with the healthier things, like, you drink the water instead of the soda, you know, it's like we're so into all these things with the sweets and the caffeine and all these other things, rather than like understanding, like, we get out of balance, I think. And so it seems like a part of meditation, right, is to kind of get some balance to your life from like all the pillars. And you're like talking about like holistic ideas of like the mind, the body, this heart and soul.
Yeah. You're going to feel more balanced. And the amazing thing is you'll be able to listen to your body better. So much of what we do in the modern day is about pushing down the pain. Let me just take this pill to cover it up. Let me ignore it. Let me distract myself from whether it be the physical pain or the emotional pains. But your body is constantly speaking to you. And if you want to listen to it when it whispers and give it what it needs, that's going to be great. Because if you don't, it's going to yell at you. You're going to get sick, right? Yeah. Yeah, it's going to scream at you. You're going to be sick. You're going to get a cold. You're going to get a flu. You're going to get an autoimmune disease if you don't listen to those subtle cues. And I find that meditation helps me build the ability to listen to what does my body really need. And don't get me wrong, I'll eat the sweets and the ice cream and stuff sometimes, but then I'll be like afterwards, okay, I'm connecting that this doesn't feel as good. I should eat less of it, or I should eat it after I eat my big salad and then have it, right? You start to connect a little clearer. You get clarity of what makes your body feel better and what makes it feel worse. And that's where your lifestyle decisions improve. And it's just a cascade. It's going to snowball into benefits in your life, including meditation leading to like happiness, joy, purpose, meaning in your life.
It's also like your mental state. And I've had a lot of talks with people in terms of like, there's a lot of shame. And there's a lot of, guilt and, in terms of like imposter syndrome, and people have these mental states. And I've talked to like, you know, somebody that was a personal trainer, 6-pack abs, looking perfectly physically in shape, but mentally they did not see themselves that way. Right. Mm-hmm. So they had this kind of problem where like you, if you don't take care of all the pillars, you physically on the outside could be perfect or pretty close to what everybody thinks you physically should be and still not be right if you've got imposter syndrome or shame or guilt or something that you haven't addressed. And so if maybe the meditation can kind of open up your eyes so you start to see, like in the looking glass, a lot of poets have that self-assessment that poets talk about when they look in that mirror, and maybe it's easier to do that and actually see what's really going on.
Yeah. And what you're saying reminds me of a Buddhist technique called metta, or loving kindness meditation. And the way we start it is we send loving kindness to ourselves. And what you just described is so common. Most people have the most difficult time sending themselves positive wishes, good vibes. They don't feel like they deserve it. But through this, you practice doing that. So your listeners can say the words, allow my words to become your own as I say them. May I be safe. Say that to yourself. May I be healthy. May I be free from suffering. May I be at ease. And then you send that love and kindness to other people. And you can go through a series of people, but let's just choose somebody random that you want to send loving kindness to right now. Anybody that comes to your mind, a loved one, a random person you saw today, may they be safe. May they be healthy. May they be free from suffering. May they be at ease. Really imagine them glowing and smiling. Notice how that feels in your own body to send that loving kindness to somebody else. And the more you practice sending it to people and to yourself, the more natural that becomes to think good wishes for people rather than being jealous, rather than being negative to yourself. And so you're practicing. It's like working out. You're building that muscle, but really you're building new neural network activity that is better for you.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, today we, you know, if you watch the news and you see the social media, there's so much like politics of like resentment or people who feel aggrieved. And instead of kind of like in the 60s, I was a child of the 70s, and it was kind of like, oh, like the love, you know, love each other, like the hippie aesthetic is like, why not love your brother, right? Well, why hate them just because they're different or they're the other? And now people seem to be going back to like camps or back to their tribe, and like, well, I'm in this tribe and I don't like that tribe and I don't like them because of X, Y, Z. And so instead of seeing, well, that's okay, it's okay, you're like, well, it's not okay. They have to mirror my tribe or they're no good at all. And we're like, well, why is that? Like, we're in the 21st century and we have less kind of peace. We have this kind of, you know, really negativity. I don't know if it's because of social media, because the tech has allowed it to get out of hand. But, you know, it just seems like people are not in that safe place or willing to give that love to other people. They might be different than themselves. And to say, well, why not? Why can't you do that?
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think the algorithm is playing to putting us in these separate tribes that are against each other. And the two-party system of politics in the U.S., it just furthers this conflict-driven media. And that's why I wrote Meditation for the Real World. This isn't meditation for monks. This isn't meditation for people that are good at meditating. This is meditation for real world, finding peace in everyday life. You can meditate as the people on the cover are doing. Like, this person is sitting on a train, on a subway, and they have their headphones on and they're meditating. So you can meditate while you wait. It could be a short 1-2 minute meditation rather than doom scrolling and getting into that negative vibe rather than getting sucked in. Take that time and do a breathing break. Check in with your body, with your intuition. You might get inspired to pull out your notebook and write some ideas down, because that inspiration comes from listening, from pausing.
Yeah, just this feeling, a lot of people don't feel they have the right, to create. You know, every person is creative, but they've kind of been taught from an early age, well, you're not Shakespeare, you're not Miles Davis, you're not Hemingway, you're not Beyonce, you're not these people. So then, therefore, you can't do it. So you should just do something else that's more productive and makes more sense. And then later you discover that you've been kind of pushing yourself down and you haven't been doing what makes you feel good. Because you're trying to meet some expectation that maybe wasn't even yours. And what you wanted to do was kind of pushed down. And I've had a lot of people on the podcast that have kind of found through some kind of, crucible moment that maybe they should do what makes them feel good. Maybe they should try to, like, look in that looking glass and address that inner child, why do I have this tendency to be in codependency? Like, why? And start to analyze it and think about it and understand the triggers. It just starts to open a pathway where, like, now you don't just accept it. You start to look at it.
I think what you're doing with interviewing creative people and telling their stories is helping others, helping them know that they're not alone, that these struggles that we go through are not unique, that you are amongst good company. And as a creative person myself, I knew I wanted to come on this podcast and chat with you because as creative people, I think that meditation is one of the biggest things we can do. And meditative movement practices like yoga, tai chi, whatever exercise or movement you enjoy, making sure that you're really present while doing it, that can help you physically getting in flow. It can help you get into that flow state too.
Now, if we get into your book, like Meditation for the Real World, and I hate to try to do the cliff note, but in terms of, like, if there are three lessons learned that people can derive from the book, not to give the book away, but, like, are there three kind of major lessons learned from the book that you could kind of speak to?
Well, one is what I already spoke to, is that anyone can meditate. If your mind wanders, that's more reason to meditate. It's boot camp for your focus, right? So, like, normalizing that mind wandering is a part of meditation. The other being that there's not just one type of meditation to solve all your problems. I feel like mindfulness has gotten so popular. It's like, oh, just be mindful all the time. Well, that's easier than said than done. So in the book, Meditation for the Real World, it's basically like a handbook for real world situations. If you're feeling depressed, you're feeling anxious, you want to get into a creative project, there's a meditation to help you get into that creative mode, or right before you create music. There's meditations for specific things, because I've had situations where I did a meditation for my anxiety at the doctor's office, and the type of meditation I did made me more anxious. Oh. So if you've ever experienced where, like, oh, that meditation didn't work for me, you might have just been doing the wrong meditation for the wrong situation. As a yoga therapist, I think it's really important to adapt for the individual, what works for you, what you enjoy, as well as for your situation, your life situation. You're about to go do a speech or a talk or a presentation, that's going to be a different meditation than winding down for bed or than getting a procedure at the doctor's office, right? So you may need to try different types of meditation. And the third thing is that you need to practice. Practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes presence. So whether you're doing a 5-minute meditation or 10-minute meditation, practice is key. And so meditation for the real world can be seen as a handbook to help give you ideas for practices for specific situations. But also if you go to meditationfortherealworld.com, I'm giving you as a gift to all your listeners, meditations that are audio meditations you can listen to that will guide you through the book and that you can use in your everyday life. And they're used with the music that was created to optimize your brain waves for the practice, to put you into those deeper states. So if you're especially into music, I think you'll enjoy these meditations.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting when you can do kind of cross-discipline kind of art mm-hmm. or creativity. And I'm a big believer, like, you know, if you have music with art and video, it's like, it touches like the idea of like a sound painting, but yes. Then a sound painting that has a video element or a sound painting that has a literary element is kind of like why you like to read the liner notes to a song, or then maybe you don't, or maybe you want to see the film that goes with the song. And because it's different perspectives. So one, you know, you could be sitting there without looking at the film, without reading the lyrics, and you heard it this way. And then you mm-hmm. read the lyrics and you see it this way, and you see the film and you see it the other way. And it's just different perspectives that kind of open your eyes. It's like, oh, wow, there's different ways to look at this.
There's I love that term. Sound painting. Sound, that is so cool. And I think of the music, you know, it's could be thought of as digital drugs is what researchers call it. But maybe I could think of it as like a brain vibration massage. Because yeah. Sometimes it literally makes you feel like you're tangling in your head. So yeah, I love that term, sound painting. I think
it kind of came from like the 60s, like Jimi Hendrix talked about mm-hmm. it around Electric Lady. They asked mm-hmm. him, like, what are these songs? Because they had all these weird sounds, like oceans and weird sonic cosmic noises. And he said, well, it's a sound painting. And then also George Martin from the Beatles talked about the process of like doing Sgt. Pepper's and Abbey Road. It's like, it's a sound painting because it's more than what the band could play physically. They use the studio to enhance things, to layer things like a painter layers their layers on a painting. You can do that with sound. And then it evokes like images.
It also not only evokes images, but it changes your neural activity. So when we listen to the sound of the ocean and we hear that like continual pattern, it, and when it's more intense, it's brown noise is what they call it. And that puts you into better sleep, better memory consolidation. Same with sounds like a waterfall or rain falling. It can be so relaxing. And so I integrate those into my audio meditations because I'm using science to enhance them for you, right? Like yeah, we can, absolutely. I love, they are sound paintings. You're probably going to visualize the ocean and some nature while you do these meditations at meditationfortherealworld.com.
That's interesting that you mentioned the brown noise, because like as a synthesis, we have like brown noise, white noise, pink noise. We have
pink.
All, mm-hmm. our, the oscillators that we use to create our sounds can yes. do very specific waveforms.
I have that in Meditation for the Real World. I talk about how you can use different sound frequencies to optimize your meditation practice. A song can be your meditation, and it tells you how to do it.
That's cool. Because a lot of times, as musicians, we start to realize, like if I'm using a square wave or a sine wave or a ramp or a pulse, and I start to see what happens to the crowd when I use it, right? And if I use those waves, then my song is full of pulse waves or sine waves or cosine waves or square waves with different rhythms and polyrhythms, you can start to see the reaction of the crowd. And you're like, wow, like if I do these combinations, I get this kind of reaction. And it kind of is like, whether something's like got a punk aesthetic or something's got a very orchestral aesthetic or it's got a jarring kind of aesthetic or a calming or a soothe, you start to realize that you can affect people with the sounds that you're making. And then you can start to make choices to like what you're trying to actually convey.
Yeah, you're becoming a conductor of the energy of the room. And I have always been into music and listen to, you know, put my headphones on to change my mood. But now in researching for this book, it's really opened up a whole new world in that music can be our drug. It can be like literally, it can be as powerful as. And so you can turn to music as a way to entrain your brain to get into these states, to become meditative more often, to be in that flow state more often. You can, I also, the songs on this album that we just released, it, some of them I put on when I'm working on something to put me in flow state. So it's not only just sitting there, you know, in meditation still, it's like you can do it while you're working, listen to specific sounds.
You can have the soundtrack to your work day. If you kind of know yourself and you know what works, either you can have on your headphone something that doesn't wreck your concentration. Like I do software design. But I could listen to some types of jazz or atmospheric music, and it doesn't really keep me from thinking deep about an algorithm.
Helps you think deeper.
I can actually get into it and actually solve the logical problem where people would say, well, how can you have music on and solve that? Don't you need to concentrate? And it's kind of like once you start to realize what you can handle and what you like and what you're brain likes and what helps you, like you said, it can actually kind of shape and make you do a better job, and that's what's really interesting.
I like how you said you put your headphones on, because a lot of the music is engineered to go from one ear to the other in a way that helps entrain your brainwave activity. So headphones do help get you into that state more.
Yeah, it's just interesting because you don't, you know, some people say, well, how can you concentrate if you've got that on? And, you know, I guess it depends on what you have on.
As long as it doesn't have words, I do find the words put me into words in my head. So for me, music without words, music with the nature sounds, the sound paintings in them, I'm learning so much from this talk.
Yeah.
They really get me into that space, into that headspace.
Yeah, orchestral or atmospheric music that kind of has, you know, pastoral kind of invocations is really interesting. I was always into bands like Yes in the 70s. They actually had a record Close to the Edge, and it opens with a field recording in a forest. Mm-hmm. And they don't even sing anything. It kind of builds up like a classical piece. It has like movements. And it starts with all this sound from the forest, like animals and river and, you know, the air going through the leaves, you can hear it. And there's something about pieces like that, you know, really can affect your brain in positive ways in terms of, you know, allowing you to kind of be in a state of calm or peace or be able to kind of get into a meditative state. It's just interesting what you can do. And I'm glad that you documented it in your book, and you've done like the scientific piece. We haven't talked about that as much, but you've done a scientific kind of analysis of why it works.
Yeah. I cited some research in there about how listening to sounds of nature and looking at images of nature puts you in the similar state as if you were there. Now, when we go there, we get even more immersed. So in Japan, they do something called forest bathing, where they basically do meditative walks through the woods. The researchers have found that this helps their immune system significantly, and they increase these natural killer cells, which is a good thing because they fight off cancer, tumors, and all sorts of bad things. And so they have looked into like why, you know, and it's partly because seeing nature and hearing nature, but it's also partly because of the aerosols of breathing in that air of the forest. That's what they really attributed to.
Coming off the plants. I mean, the plants are generating all these chemicals
that are healing,
that are actually necessary for humans, but we kind of put ourselves in these cities and taken ourselves out of the environment, and we lost some of the restorative features of nature because we felt like, oh, we don't need to be part of it. And I think this kind of modern dilemma is like, you kind of need to get yourself back into the earth, like kind of have a better relationship with Gaia.
And even if it's just a blue space, like a fountain, or a green space, like a little park, they've shown that those are beneficial for our health. So taking a break, and I give techniques in the book, like a walking meditation through the park, so that your walk, listening to music, can be your meditation as a break from work. You're going to come back way more rejuvenated and able to get into that flow state.
Yeah, that's interesting, because they have these little parks in Tokyo that people would do Tai Chi in. And I was living like near Roppongi. And like, I was in this heavy central business district, but they had these little like ponds and little, like, I don't know, tiny little parks, but they're more like places where people could meditate, and they could go into these areas and you'd see people doing Tai Chi, people just walk in little fish pond, and people just sitting by the fish pond or walking around. And they would go during the day and take a break. Mm-hmm. And these guys, you know, in Tokyo is a very fast paced city, and people are working really hard, working crazy hours, but they would take the time to come out and do those things. They kind of give themselves these restorative nature breaks in the middle of the city. And I got into it, and I said, wow, I feel a lot better than if I just sitting in the cube all day. Versus just doing that.
Yeah, even 10 minutes out in nature, 5 minutes makes a difference for our health. And if you can be mindful, you can integrate a little meditation into it, you're going to expand those benefits.
Definitely. I want to thank you again for being a guest on the show. The hour always goes by quicker than we ever imagined. And again, we've got meditationfortherealworld.com. You'll be able to fully click on it. All the links we have on the description of the podcast are going to be clickable. And I do want to thank you for being a guest on the podcast today. And we were live on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch. And we will be on all the major platforms that podcast can be watched or listened to by tomorrow. And
great.
I want to thank you again for being on the show.
Thank you. It was great to chat with you.
Have a good night.
You too.